Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, and welcome to a Smart Talk road trip coming to you today from the North Museum of Nature and Science in Lancaster. This Saturday marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing and astronaut Neil Armstrong taking man's first steps on the moon. You're probably hearing many superlatives to describe this historic moon landing this week, but it has to be ranked as one of the greatest accomplishments of the human race, and the United States in particular. On today's program, we'll discuss the moon landing and the U.S. space program today and tomorrow. Joining us is Dr. David Fisher, professor of physics and astronomy, and he's a space flight historian at Lycoming College. Dr. Fisher, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Tom Usiak, who is a photographer of missions since Apollo. Mr. Usiak, good to see you.
Good morning.
And Axel Diaz, a solar system ambassador at NASA. Axel Diaz, that is an impressive title, I have to say.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you, and welcome to the program. We are not taking phone calls during today's road trip, but we encourage our audience, and we have a nice-sized audience here at the North Museum. We're in the planetarium, and I have to say that I'm like the kid who it's something that I've always dreamed of. Above us, we have a Smart Talk logo interspersed with some iconic photographs from Apollo 11 right over my shoulder. I don't know if it's still there or not. Yes, it is. That iconic photograph of Buzz Aldrin, second man on the moon, and in the visor of his helmet, you see the reflection of Neil Armstrong and the American flag and the lunar module. That's just one of the many photographs around here. Just a perfect location for stargazing, talking about space. Dr. David Fisher, let me start with you. This 50th anniversary brings back a lot of memories for a lot of people. Why is this so significant?
Well, I think it's something that for a particular group of people of a certain age, it was something that is one of those things you'll always remember where you were when it happened. And the kind of person I'm talking about had, unfortunately, a lot of bad memories of that era. You knew where you were when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. You knew where you were when Martin Luther King was assassinated. You knew where you were when Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And times were very turbulent in that era. And then there was the space program as the backdrop. Against all that turmoil, against all that negativity in the country, there was something that just about everybody was behind, for perhaps the strangest reasons of all, to beat the Russians to the moon. All right, and we could get into that later, perhaps, but why did we go to the moon then? Well, because that was the time to do this. Every political aspect and every economic aspect and every industrial aspect came together at a crossroads to make it possible that in the 60s we could go to the moon. We couldn't have done it before, and chances are if we didn't do it then, we may never have been to the moon yet. But it was the perfect time. And then, well, there we are. We're all as a country, all as a world, actually, looking at what went on with Apollo 11 and cheering on the astronauts, worrying about their safety, and then just saying, oh my God, they did it, and moved on from there in the 70s. But that was something that was perfect to end the decade that was the 60s.
One of the things that is so unique about the Apollo program, well, there are several, more than several, a lot. But when President John F. Kennedy said in the early 60s that America's goal would be to land the moon's man safely on the moon and return him safely to Earth by the end of the decade. There was nothing in place to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, America had sent some satellites up, and you know, John Glenn and Alan Shepard, early astronauts, were ready to make some space flight, but everything almost had to be invented.
Yeah.
They started from scratch, and in an eight-year period,
right.
That's landed man on the moon.
That's something that most people don't remember about the speeches. You know, we choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they're easy, but because they are hard, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, spurring on to greatness. But later on, he talks about the actual sensibilities in that speech, and people don't remember that part of it, where he says specifically, Basically, paraphrasing, it's impossible to go to the moon today. We have to invent new materials. We have to invent new equipment. We have to do things with computers that are just not available right now. Like you were saying, you had to have everything invented because I'm a physicist. Yeah, the physics of sending somebody to the moon is a relatively simple thing. I can assign that as homework. But engineers had to make it happen. And that was the marvel that was Apollo, going from the simplistic idea of, okay, here's some things you worry about, gravitational forces, energy, kinetic, the thrust equation for how rockets behave. But that's easy to put on a blackboard and on paper, but to actually do it, that's a very different thing.
What was the most difficult part of landing a man on the moon?
Someone mentioned that beforehand. I'm sorry, I'm terrible with names. Naturally, a professor is terrible with names. But a young woman who spoke about John Hobolt, I had a great chance opportunity to meet him in New Hampshire at the Christa McAuliffe Planetarium. He just showed up. I went there with a student who was at MIT for the summer doing some research. I said, let's go see this planetarium. And he shows up. I hadn't planned to try to see him any particular time, but he was there and talking for the longest time about how they chose to go to the moon. And well, I knew the story, but it's great to hear it from the person who came up with it. He was relentless. No one within NASA wanted to do it the way we ultimately did go to the moon. Dr. Wernher von Braun wanted to do what was called Earth orbit rendezvous. You need two rockets, not as big as Saturn V, but two very big rockets, and then they join up together in Earth orbit and send out the spacecraft directly to the moon. The easiest way, with quotation marks around the word easiest, was something called direct ascent. You just launch one enormous rocket directly at the moon. It turns around, it lands like an old 50s science fiction movie on its tail fins, and then launches and comes back to Earth. So the astronauts have very little to do. They're just along as passengers. The thing is, the thing that required the most piloting skills ended up being lunar orbit rendezvous. But Hobolt argued that if we're going to do this according to Kennedy's timescale and do it in a reasonable amount of money, you got to do it where the astronauts have to break the spaceship apart into various parts and do a rendezvous in the lunar sphere of influence so that only part of the spacecraft eventually comes home. And that gave us Saturn V. He would not stop arguing for lunar orbit rendezvous until everybody said, you know, you're right. And they just very begrudgingly realized that that was the cheapest way, the only way that they'd get it done, but it's also the riskiest way. But it turned out also is the best way.
You say the riskiest way. There came a point when, after Apollo 1, which three astronauts were killed, but Apollo 7 was a flight that went almost perfectly. We're learning so much about the Apollo program this week that Apollo 7 went almost perfectly, other than the astronauts themselves got sick and had a few disagreements with mission control in Houston, but the mission itself went almost perfectly. What I'm getting at is that by the time of Apollo 11, we didn't even consider that there could be a safety, that there could be some danger involved, because we as Americans came to expect the space program to be perfect. Mm-hmm. But what you were just talking about, the lunar module that was running out of gas when it was, okay, gas, fuel.
Fuel.
Okay? Yeah.
It's not
like that. Yeah, it's not like it had unleaded, yeah. You know? 93 octane. Anyway, that the lunar module was running out of fuel just a few, more than a few feet from the surface of the moon, and that famous line that you'll hear throughout the week, I'm sure if you watch any of the programs, where Houston said, after they landed, when Neil Armstrong said, the Eagle has landed Tranquility Base here, mm-hmm. that on the ground they said, well, you have a bunch of guys who just have turned blue, we're breathing again, because, and what many people didn't know at the time was how close that was to being a disaster.
Yeah. They had a number of problems on the way down, and some of them popped up for the first time with the astronauts. A 1201 and a 1202 computer alarm, which basically the computer was saying, hey, you're asking me too much to do. Knock it off. I can't do all this. And after all, remember, the computer technology back then, your smartphone is orders of magnitude better than the lunar module computer. In fact, this cheapo $5 watch here has a better memory than did the lunar module computer, the display and keyboard, or DISCI, as they called it. And on the way down, that kept going. A young man, age 26, recognized what that was. And he said, okay, that's an alarm that we're safe. As long as the computer doesn't act up worse than this, we can keep going. And so they were able to continue going on down, but then Armstrong looks out the window and says, I don't like where this is taking me. And he just turns the lunar module this way so that he's got thrust going out the bottom, pushing him forward. And he just basically, it's kind of like hitting the gas on a car. And he just accelerates horizontally across the surface, and the controllers are wondering, what is he doing? Where is he going? And in the process, he's burning fuel, burning time, and he just calmly wants to get the right place, and he puts it down, and it turns out there was no gas gauge by any means. They had to estimate based upon a number of things. The only warning they got was low level, which meant there's only 40 seconds left. And it turned out that was an error. They actually did have a little bit more gas than they thought. But nevertheless, mission control was, they just basically, for the last 30 seconds, Gene Kranz, the flight director, said, stop talking, you know, just let them land it. And 30 seconds, they were on their own, and it was either make or break.
We're going to talk more about the Apollo mission in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. That murmur you hear in the background is our audience that got quiet all of a sudden. We're on a Smart Talk road trip today at the North Museum of Nature and Science, actually in the planetarium, a perfect location for talking about the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, Neil Armstrong's first step on the moon that is coming up on July 20th, which is this Saturday. Joining us on today's program is Dr. David Fisher, professor of physics and astronomy and space flight historian at Lycoming College, Tom Usiak, who is a photographer of missions since Apollo, and Axel Diaz, a solar system ambassador at NASA. I should mention this Smart Talk road trip is supported by Roof Advisory Group, Michael's Motor Cars, and the North Museum of Nature and Science. And by the way, I have to say this because we're reminiscing so much today. Michael's Motor Cars, there's a 1966 Ford Thunderbird parked right out front that is just perfect condition. Now, yes, Michael says that it was new in 1969. It looked new, but again, just so many things that remind you of the late 1960s. And that car, when you look at it, it reminds you of a time when there was American ingenuity in making automobiles and spacecraft. So I want to thank Michael for doing that. I'm sure that there will be a lot of people, once they have gone through the North Museum and have seen everything there is to see here, will stop and take a look at that Thunderbird as well. Tom Usiak, photographer of missions since Apollo. Tell me how you got involved with, I hate to say taking pictures, but photographing the Apollo missions.
Well, I was always interested in the space program from the beginning, and I had a very strong interest in photography. So as time went on, I just put the two together. My first mission as a media photographer was Apollo 15 in 1971. I was a student at Millersville University. It was called Millersville State College then. And I had the idea that I wanted to cover a launch. And my wife said to me, why don't you go see the school newspaper advisor and see what they would say? So we did, and they were willing to accredit me as a college journalist. And up to that point, there hadn't been that many. There was one for Apollo 11. A friend of mine who just wrote a book called I Was a Teenage Space Reporter, and he was, I believe, the first college journalist to be accredited by NASA, and that was for Apollo 11. And then we covered the remaining Apollo missions, the Skylab missions, the Apollo-Soyuz test project, and a lot of space shuttle missions, not every one of them, but what we covered what were called the high-profile missions, you know, the first 10 or so, and then, like, the Hubble Space Telescope, the John Glenn's return to space on the shuttle, the big planetary programs.
You have a lot of experience with it. But take me back to Apollo 11. Even though you didn't photograph Apollo 11, what are your memories of the launch of the moon landing, of Neil Armstrong stepping on the moon?
Well, I'd been out of high school about a month when Apollo 11 was launched here, and what would be a few minutes from now, 50 years ago. And I just watched it. I watched CBS, Walter Cronkite. I switched back and forth between CBS and NBC because I like Walter Cronkite.
You weren't watching WYPF?
Frank McGee. No.
Okay. I understand. Well, it was Walter Cronkite. I understand. Okay.
And Frank McGee with NBC, I was a fan of his. I just watched every minute of it. I took some pictures off the TV screen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 1/30th of a second on the camera and with black and white film because the moonwalk was in black and white.
Yeah.
And just covered it all and just followed all the missions. I mean, I followed all the missions from the very beginning, all the Mercury, the Gemini, and then into Apollo. And, you know, just the photography aspect of it, which I was involved with, and the interest in the space program just sort of merged and became one.
Dr. Fisher had mentioned the Saturn V, and for those who weren't around or aren't familiar, Saturn V was the rocket that launched the Apollo's missions into space.
Correct.
19 stories tall.
36 stories tall.
Was it 36? Okay. What was 19? Something was 19.
Saturn 1B?
Perhaps,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, all right.
Sounds about right.
See, I'm getting my rockets mixed up.
Maybe Gemini.
It was 50 years ago, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, describe what that rocket was like as you're photographing a 36-story high rocket.
Well, you're at the press site, which is 3.5 miles from the launch pad. So you're standing there with your camera looking out toward the rocket, and 8.9 seconds is when they would say ignition sequence start. So you, as the count went down towards zero, you'd see this little fireball come up underneath the rocket, and then this giant wall of flame coming out both sides. And then it would sit there and build thrust and then eventually lift off. Now, the thing that will always impress me about the Saturn V launches, and I did four of them, was that giant wall of flame, which I've yet to see duplicated anywhere. And then the fact that when it lifted off, unlike the shuttle took off pretty quickly, but the Saturn V creeped up the tower. And it was up and cleared the tower, and you still hadn't heard it. It was still silent. All you could hear there in the press site was the clicking of cameras and people oohing and ahhing. And then slowly but surely the noise would come across, you know, the land there, and then it would start as a low rumble, and then it would build up to that. And then when it was up, it started sounding like fireworks, like not just a steady roar, but like a pop and a bang bang like that. And it would just go out over the ocean and would disappear. And then you would look out at the launch pad, at the mobile launcher sitting there, and there was just water flushing down over that, coming off the levels of the launcher and flooding the deck of the launcher to keep it cool from that exhaust. Mm. And then it was over.
So of the Apollo flights that you photographed, what was your favorite?
Apollo 16.
Why is that?
Because it was the most beautiful, it was a daytime launch. Now, Apollo 17 was spectacular. It's a night launch.
Mm-hmm.
Until, I mean, the liftoff of that, until it cleared the tower and was flying, then you really didn't see much more except the flame. But Apollo 16, it was a perfect day for launch. It was a clear blue sky, deep blue sky. And what I always remember from that is the contrast in the yellow flame sitting there burning on the pad and against that deep blue sky. And then when it took off, it just creeped up the tower like that. And that was, that's what I remember.
Didn't you say that many people told you, was it Apollo 16 that was very much like Apollo 11 as far as the...
Apollo 15,
15
was,
okay.
Because the launch of Apollo 15 took place about 9:35, 9:36 in the morning on July 26th. Apollo 11 took place 9:32 today,
five
minutes from now, yes. And at that time of the year, the where the sun is in the sky, the lighting, the overall weather conditions were similar. Sometimes I put a picture of Apollo 11 down and a picture of Apollo 15 from the press site, And the only difference I could see there is the fact that the countdown clock was not there for Apollo 11, but it was for Apollo 15, the big clock that stood in the press site.
And we're going to count down to 9:32, when it would be 50 years ago today, 9:32 a.m., that Apollo 11 was launched. Joining us now is Axel Diaz, and Axel Diaz is an ambassador with NASA, a solar system ambassador with NASA. Mr. Diaz, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
What does a solar system ambassador do for NASA?
Yes, what we do here in Pennsylvania, we do events to communicate what NASA is doing lately in science, in space. For example, what's happening in Mars. Basically, what happened with your tax money? Where's my money going for NASA? What are they doing with my money? So what happened in the space station? Why we want to go to Mars? So share the excitement of NASA with the public. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. So we do events anywhere, in schools, like here. We do events about NASA.
Your audience, typically ages of your audience, what?
It can be any age. It can be from kids 5 to 7 years old to adults, any age.
Mm-hmm. 50 years after, you're obviously not you don't remember the 1969.
I mean, I turned 50 last month. I'm 50 years old.
Oh, you are?
Yes, I am.
You don't look 50 years old.
I turned 50 last month.
So you're an Apollo baby.
Exactly.
Well, again, yeah, I was...
Thank you. Thank you for the compliment.
I wasn't exaggerating. He doesn't look 50, does he?
No,
he
that's good.
Look.
That's good.
All right. So when people ask questions about Apollo 11 or the Apollo program, what do they ask? What are they most interested in?
One question they asked me last year in particular was always is in my mind about the fake moon landing.
The fake moon landing.
This young lady came to me, maybe she was 24, 25, asking me about the fake moon landing. That said, you know that was fake. So you're asking me, you're telling me that was fake. So you know what? So I asked her, do you know why we went to the moon? So yeah, we went to the moon to explore, to learn more about the moon. Said, no. We went to the moon to beat the Soviets. That's why we went to the moon.
She probably said, what's a Soviet?
I asked her, did they say something about, did they complain about us not going to the moon? Did they say something about the fake moon landing? I said, I don't think so. There you go. So when people ask me about the fake moon landing, I said, are you kidding me? Are you really?
Wow. You know, and you mentioned money, and people wonder how their money was spent for the Apollo mission, the entire space program, because after a while, you did hear many people say, why do we spend all this money to send these rockets into space? We could be using that money on so many other programs. That money, in many people's minds, was well spent. The experiments conducted by Apollo 11 and the astronauts overall, what tangible results did Americans see from that? Did the world see from that?
If you look today, the technology we have today, we had GPS, we had cell phones, all the technology we have today came from Apollo, the computers. All that money invested, because like you mentioned before, you had to learn from scratch. You had no technology, you didn't have it back in the 60s, to build computers, to build the launch vehicle. But today, we have that today. Today we had the satellites, like I mentioned before, we had the GPS, cell phone, that came from the Apollo era.
Mm. Well, we are about 30 seconds away. I don't know, should I give a countdown to 9:32? That 50 years ago today, at this moment, Apollo 11 is about to be launched just 20 seconds from now. But kind of gives you goosebumps when you think about it and think about that launch 50 years ago. And again, I'm not going to do the whole 10, 9, 8 thing, but it is coming up on 9:32. And you think back to 50 years ago, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Liftoff.
Liftoff. We have liftoff. Yeah. That's what it sounded like. Yep. Maybe it was a little more dramatic than that. 50 years ago, but 50 years ago now at this moment, America was on its way to space and on its way to the moon. So, Axel, how does one become an ambassador for NASA?
Yes, you have to apply just once a year. The application opens in September. You go online at the NASA website, you apply. It's like a maybe 2 pages long application. Once you apply, you have to wait 5 months. 5 months where they do your background check, they call your, you have to provide 5 references, they call the people. And of course, on my case, when I applied back in 2015, on my back of my head, I thought, they never call me. It's not going to happen. I just applied because I had nothing to lose. Like I said before, that was in September, and then they tell you, we called you in December, the first week of December, and nothing happened. Second week of December, I was waiting, nothing happened. So I thought, okay, it's not going to happen.
Were you disappointed with that?
I was. Yeah. Yeah, I was. On the third week of December, I remember my manager came to me because he was part, one of my references, my manager. He came to me because I never told the people that put in the application that I applied for being a NASA ambassador. He came to me one morning and said, hey, you know, somebody called me from NASA yesterday asking me about you. I said, really? I thought that was a joke. And they explained to him what happened. Then all the friend of mine, he's a lawyer, he called me. Hey, somebody called me from NASA asking me about you. I said, really? So I had to let people know, hey, somebody called you from NASA, this is why. And then after that, like a week later, I got the day before Christmas, December 24, I got a big envelope. I was selected by NASA. That was one of the happiest days of my life.
Now, were you always interested in the space program?
Since I remember, always since I'm 9 years old, and always I love space, I love science. That's my passion.
Yeah.
That's why for me to share my passion with the public, for me, this is amazing for me.
Well, then you're sitting in the right location.
Absolutely.
Right now at the North Museum of Nature and Science, and with all these iconic photographs on the dome and inside here, it's just incredible. But Dr. Fisher, before we move on to our next segment, when Axel was telling the story about the young woman who said that the moon landing was fake, I mean, first of all, just as someone who witnessed it, it makes me angry to think that there are conspiracy theories out there that actually get some traction. Mm-hmm. You met Buzz Aldrin.
A couple of times, yeah.
Buzz Aldrin was the second man on the moon, and Buzz Aldrin has a bit of a reputation of being a little bit different. Neil Armstrong, he was kind of a down-the-middle kind of guy, kind of eccentric himself, but Buzz Aldrin was not a down-the-middle kind of guy. And there's a famous incident just a few years ago where a conspiracy theorist confronted Buzz Aldrin and said, this never happened, that it was fake, that there was no moon landing. What happened?
Well, that fellow was bothering every one of the moonwalkers that he could find, and he was insisting that they swear on a Bible that they went to the moon. And despite the fact that Buzz has some spirituality, in fact, he gave himself communion on the moon, in a very quiet ceremony when there's just a few minutes of lull in the activity. But Buzz had had enough of this guy, and he just up and one punch and nailed him. And the funny punchline of that was that was incidental. I couldn't have thought of that myself.
You've been planning that for years.
No, but the punchline to that was when he was put before a judge. The judge basically said, you shouldn't go around doing that, Mr. Aldrin. But considering the provocation. Case dismissed. that was the end of it. He said something to the effect of, at your age, to be able to do that in one punch, judge sort of going out of character and say, I don't condone this, but, it's almost like he was silently clapping.
don't ruin, again, one of the biggest achievement in human history by, some guy coming up and saying it never happened.
Could I add something to what Axel was saying about, you asked him the question about, what did we get from going to the moon? And the thing is, that's a very hard question to answer. What do we get from the space program? The thing is, people who ask that question want you to point to something, say specifically, we got that. And the thing is, just sitting here, I thought of the perfect answer, in my opinion, right now is there was no one thing. It's everything. Axel brought that up, the technology that we have. But it's not just the technology, the acceleration of technological development to go from vacuum tubes of the 50s to integrated circuits that were necessary in order to put big pieces of equipment into smaller form to be able to be launched on Saturn V. We're still riding the waves of that, but you know, we got to get back to new innovations, which something like the space program really pushes. There are other ways that you can do that, yes, but that's the way we did do the innovation and put us forward in technology tremendously over our competitors. Sooner or later, they're all going to catch up. What's next?
Axel mentioned Mars, but right. What's next?
Well, right now the thinking is, you know, the problem with the space program since the Apollo missions is that the winds of change of in Washington can't keep a mission prolonged the way it was with Apollo through Eisenhower, even though Apollo wasn't set up in Eisenhower, but its roots go to Eisenhower, then to Kennedy, then to Johnson, then through Nixon. Thing is, what happened with Bush? Bush the second wanted us to go back to the moon to stay. He had a great program set up through the NASA administrator, who was a physicist and thought more logically about things. Plug for physics people. But then Obama came and killed the program. Obama came up with something else, which borrowed heavily upon that. And actually, it wouldn't have worked for Bush anyway because he didn't fund it. He had a great idea, but you need the funding. So Obama killed that when he came into the presidency. And wanted us to go to an asteroid, which really didn't make an awful lot of sense. It was not a program. It was just a one- or two-shot thing. And then what do you do after that? Well, believe it or not, the Trump administration has something going, for whatever reason. I'm not entirely sure yet, but to go back to the moon, and he's not going to wait. He wants it done while he's still a president, assuming he gets a second term. Because out of the blue, NASA was poked in the ribs, essentially, and said, you know, I want you to go back to the moon, but you're going to do it by 2024. And they're looking around basically the same way they did back in 1961 when Kennedy was talking about this. How can we possibly do this? And so they're going to have figure out with this new system, which borrows heavily all the way back to the Bush program. They just changed the name. Originally, it was called the Ares rocket, and now it's a space launch system, which may launch next year about this time of year. Chances are it's going to be delayed another year, but possibly getting there. And in about three missions, they'll be on the surface of the moon by way of something called the Lunar Gateway, where there's going to be a mini space station at a point near the moon that astronauts go to. You have a reusable, well, half-reusable lunar module type of affair. The ascent stage can be refueled and used again. You need a new lander every time, but it'll make use of commercial rockets to send various parts there in addition to the huge rocket that the Orion spacecraft, that is the new thing that's carried over all the way through the post-shuttle era. It's been launched once on a major mission. I happened to see that launch back in 2014. NASA terminology, EFT-1 mission. But basically, it just went up to a high altitude, rammed itself through the atmosphere to check out the heat shield, and everything worked fine. So Exploration Mission 1 is the first one, unmanned. Exploration Mission 2 goes to the moon. Number 3, supposed to land.
Well, I don't know. It just won't have the same feel as Apollo 11, but
good.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. I want to thank our guest, Dr. David Fisher, Tom Usiak, and Axel Diaz. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are on a Smart Talk road trip today at the North Museum of Nature and Science in Lancaster on the campus of Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster. This Smart Talk road trip is supported by Roof Advisory Group, Michael's Motor Cars, and the North Museum of Nature and Science. 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing coming up Saturday. Just a few minutes ago, we marked the 50th anniversary to the minute of the launch of Apollo 11 on July 16th, 1969. Now, continue our conversation, and joining us now to talk about, the North Museum, talk about space, Cosmic Mike, Senior Astronomy Educator at the North Museum. You know, I know you have that name trademark, right?
Yeah. So it's the museum thought I should have a nickname, and so there you have it.
Okay. Can I call you Cosmic?
You can, yes.
Okay. Kazi or you know, something like
Cosmic as well.
Lane Davis, President of the Astronomy Enthusiast of Lancaster County. Mr. Davis, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Ron Bolton, York County Astronomy Society. Mr. Bolton, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And I want to tell our audience here at the North Museum and the Planetarium that if you have a question or comment for our guest, step right up to the microphone and you can ask your question. Cosmic Mike, let's talk about the North Museum and what's available here. You know, I've mentioned throughout the program of just the location we're in that, you know, bringing back memories of Apollo 11 with seeing the iconic photographs that are projected over our heads. But that's just one part of the museum. This is a big deal this week for the North Museum, isn't it?
It is a huge deal, and hence why we are having programming kicking off today and running all the way through July 24th, just to sort of celebrate the entire mission of Apollo 11. So we have a lot of programming, activities, and then also from a lot of people on the panel today, they're actually coming back to the North Museum to present a talk. So for example, Ron is coming back tomorrow to talk about our lunar neighbor, and then David Fisher and Tom and Axel will all come back as well.
Mm-hmm. Just, if you will, describe all the lengths that you went to. What did you bring to the museum to mark that 50th anniversary?
just trying to make partnerships and collaborations with the people within the community to try to help put this programming together so we can make the connection of not only helping people to reminisce about what happened 50 years ago, but also try to touch the younger generation that didn't experience it and educate them about, yes, this did truly happen, and this is why we are celebrating it.
Well, what do young people want to need to know about space travel?
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, it's going to be in their future. So with the new initiatives, we are planning to go back to the moon. We're planning to go to Mars eventually. And it's people that are younger than I that are going to be able to make that happen. So we need everybody within the community, the engineers and scientists and you know, anybody on all levels to help make that a reality for us.
Mm-hmm. But why?
Why? Well, mankind has this curiosity. We have this sense of we want to explore, we want to learn new things, but then for a lot of us in astronomy, we want to learn more about where did we come from, how did the solar system form, and that's one of the things that we learn by studying the moon is where did the Earth come from?
We have one of our audience members who stepped right up. And can I ask your name and your question or comment?
Yes. My name's Emily Vasey, and I'm a retired fourth grade teacher who taught science to many hundreds of students over the years. And my question is, what are we doing? And basically, is this addressed to our ambassador and you gentlemen as well to really make sure that girls and women are totally involved in this next stage. We all know that women were integral in that whole Apollo 11. Wouldn't have happened without some of those brilliant mathematicians. So what are we doing in order to make sure that girls are involved
well? And let me just follow up on that, because several times we've discussed this on Smart Talk, and we know it is a real issue even today that there aren't as many young women, girls, involved in the STEM subjects in school. That, you know, the research has shown that they tend to, if they're interested, when they graduate high school, you know, that's the end of it, where when it comes to the science, technology, engineering, and math topics, boys, the men, tend to go on. What can be done about that? And, you know, I thank you very much for the question, because it is a great question. But Cosmic Mike, I mean, I don't know what the North Museum can do about that, but it is a real issue.
It is a real issue, and it's close to... it's close to us because we want to see more women be involved in science in general, not just astronomy. And as Emily mentioned, yeah, they were an integral part of the Apollo missions as well. And so here at the museum, because we are so passionate about trying to get more women involved, we have a program called STEM Sisters. And so we are inviting them to the museum. We're getting them out into the community to visit other businesses to see what's actually involved in their careers in that profession in hopes to get them more excited and interested in going into the sciences.
I'm curious, Lane Davis and Ron Bolton with astronomy societies in York and Lancaster County, a lot of women involved?
Some.
What's some?
Some. My wife. She's actually in the audience.
Okay. Well, that's good. Okay. But, I mean, I'm assuming when you say some that there are still more males than females.
Yes. And age is a factor.
Okay. In what way?
We need young people. We need young boys, girls, any young ones.
How do we get the young women, young men more involved?
That's a tough one because you got so many other devices that they're in their way, you know, and you've got apps now that they look at.
Rather than the real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I see we have another question, sir. Your name and your question. I know you need. You're a little tall.
A little bit tall. Hi, I'm Alan Olson here from down from Lebanon County, and I don't have a question, but I have an observation, and that is, I'm an engineer and went to Illinois Tech in Chicago, and I was quite surprised when I went back there for a class reunion several years ago. I was really surprised at the number of women that are around, and not just walking around, but in classes, because I participated in a couple of the classes. And I keep hearing about so few women in STEM, but Illinois Tech is definitely somehow doing their job. In fact, not only there were a fair number of women, I mean, when I was there, you were lucky if maybe one woman would be in your engineering or mathematics class. Well, now, I don't know what the numbers are, but it's got to be pretty close to half.
Well, that's good. That's good.
And not only that, but looking around, some of the major science and engineering departments, two of them have women department heads. Illinois Tech is really doing its job. Somebody ought to look into how are they so much more successful.
There probably are other schools that could take a few lessons.
Right.
Thank you very much for making that observation. Lane Davis, let's talk about the astronomy enthusiast of Lancaster County. How did this all come about?
That's a good question. I've been president for a while now, and the club's been in business for about, I think, 12 years. But there's been such a rollover in membership that I haven't found out yet how it actually got started. But it originally got started here in the North Museum. Mike would know more about that than I do the first few years.
But Muddy Run in southern Lancaster County now.
Yes.
Okay, just made a facial expression I don't understand.
Okay.
Muddy Run is
we, we've been involved with Muddy Run right from the beginning. And originally, we had our own public outreach programs. We would hold star watches, public star watches, in Central Park here in Lancaster. But we've shifted all our public outreach efforts now down to Muddy Run. So we're involved there every month in their open houses, star watches.
What's there?
There are two observatories built by Exelon, and they hold an open house. Everybody gets to look through the two telescopes that are in there. Mm-hmm. And inside the visitor center right next door, we hold talks trying to teach astronomy. Mm-hmm. And so far, very successful. We have several hundred people, typically, at an open house. But we're still trying to get certain programs that we originally targeted going, such as outreach to high schools in terms of access to the technology and the domes.
When you look through one of those microscopes, what do you look for?
Oh, gosh. We look at planets. We look at stars. We look at galaxies. We take pictures of them. We study them. Comets. All sorts of things.
But is there one thing in particular you look for when you look through one of those microscopes?
If it's there, I always start with Saturn. And the reason is because it's one of the few objects in the night sky that looks exactly through a telescope like it does in the pictures.
And it's a little bit different than other planets in the solar system
as
well.
It's a wow.
Yeah.
That's what you get, a wow.
Well, Ron Bolton, let's talk about that wow factor, if you will. With the York County Astronomical Society, you work a lot with younger children, nine to 10 years old.
Yeah.
What are you trying to impart on them?
It's all about outreach. I mean, you want to reach these people. I mean, we got telescopes. Members like to do their own little thing, but it's still all about outreach.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the telescopes. I'm curious. I ask Elaine, what about you? When you're looking through a telescope and kids are looking through telescopes, what are they looking for?
They're looking for that Hubble telescope picture. That's what they're looking for.
They want the exact same experience.
And yes, you're going to have to downgrade their picture to look at what it actually looks like, because you're using an eye that's more imperfect than a photograph that can be, you know, saturated.
I understand that Apollo 11 helped to inspire your love of space, right?
Oh, absolutely.
In what way?
Nine. I was nine.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know how TV was, cartoons, TV, they were going from the Westerns to space programming, you know, and you had an interest there, and then the Apollo, and I started watching Walter Cronkite, you know, all the time, stayed up every minute, yeah, and that eventually got me into telescopes. How do you do that? My parents, Blue Light Special at Kmart. And off I'm running.
They worked. The specials, the Blue Light specials where you get a telescope at the Five and Dime or at that mm-hmm. time Kmart.
Yes.
It really worked. But one of the things you talk about to children is the surface of the moon. What was it like? What do you say to them?
Sure. Just take a look at it. And usually I like to participate. I make them participate. I ask them a question and try to draw them in. And take one look at the moon. You think it's hot or cold? Well, they say cold, of course. No, not in the sunlight. And then you build from there. How hot was it? What was it like to touch it?
I always had a question. Okay, now I'm showing my space geekiness here. When Neil Armstrong is standing next to the flag is outstretched. On Earth, that would be from the wind. What is it on the moon? Gravity?
Oh, no, it's wires in there.
For 50 years, I was thinking it was something else. And are you serious?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that just ruined my whole thing.
Would you really want to look at a flag that's just like flat?
No,
like this along the pole?
No.
You had to have this thing flying. You know,
I thought it was gravity or something like that. That would not. Okay. We have an audience member. Sir, your name and question?
Hello. I just want to say this has been great so far. I'm Dave Mitski. I'm a member of the Astronomical Society of Harrisburg, two other clubs, and I'm a former member of the AELC. And I just wanted to say that after Apollo 18 through 20, those missions were canceled, the space program sort of got sidetracked with the shuttle and the ISS. And part of the reason for that was they thought there was no water on the moon. And there's good evidence now that there is water. And if you have water, you don't have to cart it to the moon. You can make rocket fuel and oxygen with that. So it's a whole new game. And now we have pressure from the Chinese as well.
Yep.
So
that's right.
Things have changed.
It is. You know, we went from the Russians to the Chinese now. And, you know, a lot of the private companies sending, although they have to do that kind of through NASA. Hey, Dave, thank you very much for making your comments.
Can I just...
I only have a minute left.
Make
but,
a
yeah,
plug.
Go ahead.
Our observatory at Lewis Berry, the Naylor Observatory, will be open to the public this coming Sunday.
Okay. Thank you very much. We only have a minute left. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. And I'm glad he brought that up, because just think of the things that we have learned in the 50 years since the first Apollo 11 landing, of the things we have learned about the solar system. I mean, Hubble, the Hubble telescope has given us views that man never would have, I mean, we could imagine them, but now we actually get to see them, and just some of the things that we've done over the last 50 years. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Ron Bolton, Lane Davis, also Cosmic Mike, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to thank our audience. Thank our audience here at the North Museum of Nature and Science on the campus of Franklin and Marshall College here in Lancaster. We're in the planetarium. Encourage everyone to visit, not just this week, but anytime, but especially this week, as you can learn so much more and reminisce so much about the Apollo 11 moon landing. This Smart Talk road trip is supported by Roof Advisory Group, Michael's Motor Cars, and the North Museum of Nature and Science. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we are back in the studio. We'll be talking about the challenges facing rural Pennsylvania. That is coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. Have yourself a good day.